A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's pointing out that the tourniquet is probably the single most common item people have in their first aid kits that they wouldn't actually know how to use if the moment came. He's asking us to walk through how to use them, how to keep them stocked, different sizes for kids and adults, how long they stay workable in storage, how often to replace them, and what they're actually useful for. So, basically, the full tourniquet audit. Where do we even start?
I want to start with the thing that most people get wrong, because it's the difference between saving a limb and losing one. A tourniquet is not a last resort. For decades, first aid training taught people to try everything else first. Direct pressure, elevation, pressure points, and only reach for the tourniquet when all else failed. The reasoning was that you'd cause unnecessary limb damage. But the data from Iraq and Afghanistan completely flipped that. When tourniquets were applied early, before massive blood loss, survival rates shot up and complication rates dropped. The real danger isn't the tourniquet. It's hesitating while someone bleeds out.
The old advice was basically, let them nearly die first, then try the thing that might have prevented that.
And it came from civilian medicine, where the assumption is you're never more than a few minutes from a trauma center. But even in cities, that's not always true, and if you're hiking or on a road trip, the math changes completely. The current guidelines from the American College of Surgeons and the Stop the Bleed campaign are clear for life-threatening limb hemorrhage, tourniquet first and fast.
Define life-threatening, because someone listening might think every bleeding cut needs a tourniquet.
Life-threatening means arterial bleeding, blood that's bright red and spurting in rhythm with the heartbeat, or pooling so fast you can't see the wound or soaking through clothing in seconds. Or if the person is pale, confused, losing consciousness. Those are signs of hemorrhagic shock. If you see any of that from a limb wound, you go straight to the tourniquet.
All right, so let's say I'm there. I've identified that this is the real thing. Walk me through the steps. I've got one of those cap tourniquets, the combat application tourniquet, the one most people have in their kits. What do I actually do?
Step 1, expose the wound. Cut or tear clothing away. Don't be gentle. This is not the moment for preserving the shirt. Step 2, place the tourniquet 2 to 3 inches above the wound, between the wound and the heart. Not directly over a joint. So if the wound is on the forearm, you go above the elbow. If it's on the calf, you go above the knee. Step 3, pull the strap as tight as you possibly can by hand, then twist the windlass rod until the bleeding stops completely. Not slows down, stops. Step 4, secure the windlass in the clip so it doesn't unwind. Step 5, note the time. Write it on the tourniquet if there's a space for it, on the person's forehead with a marker, or just remember it. That time matters for the hospital.
Why does the time matter?
Because the longer a tourniquet is on, the higher the risk of permanent nerve and muscle damage. The general window is about 2 hours before you start seeing significant risk of ischemic injury. That doesn't mean the limb is doomed at 2 hours and 1 minute. There are cases of tourniquets being on for 4, 6, even 8 hours with the limb saved. But 2 hours is the threshold where surgeons start getting very concerned. After about 6 hours, the amputation risk becomes substantial. The time note tells the trauma team how urgent the situation is.
What about the thing people worry about? That you're going to put it on and then take it off too early, and the person bleeds out from the toxins that built up.
That's a real thing, but it's not about toxins in the way most people think. It's called reperfusion injury. When blood flow is cut off, metabolic waste products build up in the tissue. If you suddenly release the tourniquet, those rush back into the bloodstream and can cause a dangerous drop in blood pressure or even cardiac arrest. That's why the rule is ironclad. Once a tourniquet is applied, only a medical professional in a controlled setting should remove it. Never loosen it to check or give the limb a break. That's how you kill someone.
Give the limb a break. The limb will wait. Good to know.
Here's something else most people don't realize. Applying a tourniquet hurts. If the person is conscious, they're going to scream. That doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It means you're doing it right. The pressure required to occlude arterial flow is significant. If it's not painful, it's probably not tight enough.
The screaming is actually reassuring in a weird way.
In the worst possible way, yes. And that leads to something important about training. You can't just buy a tourniquet, toss it in a bag, and assume you'll figure it out under pressure. The research is pretty stark. In one study, something like 60% of laypeople couldn't apply a tourniquet effectively without prior hands-on practice. They didn't tighten it enough, placed it wrong, or couldn't secure the windlass properly.
The item in your kit is only as good as the practice you put in.
And tourniquets are actually great for practice, because you can train with a dedicated training tourniquet. Same mechanism, same feel, but usually a different color, light blue, so nobody mistakes it for the real one in an emergency. The muscle memory matters because when someone's bleeding in front of you, your fine motor skills go out the window.
The cognitive load of crisis. Your brain just doesn't access complex steps the same way.
And this is where the design of modern tourniquets is brilliant. The CAT, the SOF tactical tourniquet, the SAMXT, they're all designed around gross motor movements. Pull, twist, clip. Big obvious actions that don't require precision. They're all built for the reality that your hands are going to be slippery with blood and your brain is going to be flooded with adrenaline.
Let's talk about the different types, because someone listening might be about to buy one and the options are confusing. What should they actually get?
The CAT Gen 7 is the most widely used and probably the one I'd recommend for most people. It's been through multiple iterations. It's COTCCC recommended. That's the Committee on Tactical Combat Casualty Care, which sets the standard for pre-hospital trauma care. And it's relatively affordable, usually around $30 to $35. The SOF tourniquet is also excellent, slightly wider, which some people prefer because it distributes pressure more evenly. The SAMXT is newer, very fast to apply one-handed, which matters if you're applying it to yourself. But here's the thing, do not buy tourniquets from random sellers on Amazon or eBay. Counterfeits are a massive problem. A fake tourniquet will look right, but the windlass will snap under pressure or the strap will tear. In testing, some counterfeits failed at less than half the required tension.
The Amazon counterfeits problem strikes again.
It's pervasive. There was a study out of the U Army Institute of Surgical Research that tested counterfeit tourniquets and found failure rates above 80%. That's not a quality control problem, that's a death trap. Buy from North American Rescue or another authorized distributor.
Buy from the source, and don't save $10 on something that needs to work the first time. Now what about the other part of Daniel's question? Children. Do you need different tourniquets for kids?
The short version is, adult tourniquets usually work on children, but with some important caveats. A standard CAT tourniquet can typically occlude arterial flow on limbs as small as about 5 inches in circumference. Below that, you might not get enough pressure. For infants and very small toddlers, the limb is simply too small for the windlass mechanism to cinch down adequately. In those cases, you'd use direct pressure and wound packing because the vessels are small enough that manual compression can actually control the bleeding.
There's a lower size limit, but for most kids past toddler age, an adult tourniquet works.
A 2020 study in the Journal of Pediatric Surgery looked at CAT tourniquet application on children aged 6 to 16 and found they were effective at occluding blood flow in every case. The key adjustment is technique. On a smaller limb, you might need extra turns of the windlass, and you need to be more careful about placement because the anatomical landmarks are closer together. There are pediatric-specific tourniquets on the market, but the data suggests the standard adult version handles most scenarios.
What about the other direction? Very large limbs. Someone with a thigh circumference that makes a standard tourniquet too short.
That's a real problem, and it's one of the reasons the SOF tourniquet is popular in some circles, because it has a slightly longer strap. But for genuinely large limbs, you can use two tourniquets side by side. That's actually standard protocol in tactical medicine. If one tourniquet doesn't stop the bleeding, apply a second one just above the first. Two tourniquets are often needed for thigh wounds on adults anyway, because the femoral artery is deep and requires a lot of pressure to occlude. So the advice is, carry at least two tourniquets. One is none, two is one.
One is none, two is one. So, stocking your kit, how many should the average person actually have?
For a personal first aid kit, I'd say two. For a family car kit, I'd say four. Two adult, and two that could work on smaller limbs. For a household, one per person plus a spare isn't unreasonable. And here's the thing, you want them accessible, not buried at the bottom of a bag. If you're bleeding from the femoral artery, you have somewhere between 60 seconds and 3 minutes before you lose consciousness. You don't have time to dig through a zippered pouch inside another zippered pouch.
The 3-second rule principle. If you can't reach it in 3 seconds, it might as well not be there.
Tourniquets should be staged. That means out of the wrap, strap folded so it deploys with one pull, windlass ready to twist. There's a specific way to stage a cat so the loop opens smoothly and you're not fumbling with Velcro while someone's bleeding. It takes 30 seconds to learn, and it's the difference between a tourniquet that works and a tourniquet that's just a prop.
All right, let's get into the storage and replacement question, because this is where I suspect a lot of people are unknowingly carrying useless equipment. How long does a tourniquet actually last in storage?
The official shelf life varies by manufacturer, but the general consensus is that a tourniquet stored in a sealed package in reasonable conditions, not in direct sunlight, not in extreme heat, has a functional life of about 5 to 10 years. North American Rescue typically lists a 10-year shelf life for the cat stored in its original packaging. But stored is the key word. A tourniquet that's been taken out, staged, and carried around in a bag or a car is a different story.
Because UV exposure and temperature cycling degrade the materials.
Nylon and plastic are tough, but they're not invincible. UV light breaks down nylon over time. Heat, especially the kind you get in a car in summer, can make plastics brittle. The windlass rod on a cat is made of a fiberglass reinforced polymer, and if that gets brittle and snaps under torque, you're in trouble. There was a study that looked at tourniquets kept in vehicles in Arizona and Texas, and they found measurable degradation in tensile strength after just 2 to 3 years of that kind of thermal cycling.
The car kit tourniquet has a much shorter practical life than the one in your climate control closet.
For a car kit, inspect every 6 months and replace every 2 to 3 years if it's been exposed to temperature extremes. For an indoor kit, inspect annually and replace every 5 to 7 years. An inspection means actually looking at it. Check the strap for fraying or discoloration, check the windlass for cracks, make sure the Velcro still grips firmly, make sure the clip mechanism isn't deformed.
What about sterile storage? The prompt mentioned that specifically. Does sterility even matter here?
It doesn't. Tourniquets are not sterile devices, and they don't need to be. The wound they're being applied near is already contaminated. It's a traumatic injury, not a surgical incision. Infection control comes later at the hospital with debridement and antibiotics. The priority is stopping the hemorrhage. What matters is that it works mechanically.
That's a relief. Because I've seen people keep their tourniquets in vacuum-sealed bags, and I always wondered if that was necessary, or just a very committed aesthetic.
It's theater. It looks professional, but it adds a barrier to deployment that could cost seconds, and seconds matter. If you want to vacuum seal something, vacuum seal a spare tourniquet that's in deep storage, not the one you need to grab in an emergency.
Alright, let's talk about what tourniquets are actually useful for. Daniel mentioned that as one of his questions, and I think people might be surprised by the range, or by the limitations.
The core use case is traumatic amputation or near amputation of a limb. Industrial accidents, car crashes, farming equipment, power tools, anything that severs or partially severs an arm or leg. But the broader category is any severe hemorrhage from a limb that can't be controlled by direct pressure. Gunshot wounds, deep lacerations from glass or metal, compound fractures where the bone has broken through the skin and severed an artery. These are all tourniquet-appropriate injuries.
What about the situations where people might reach for a tourniquet but shouldn't?
Head wounds, neck wounds, torso wounds. You cannot tourniquet a neck. You cannot tourniquet a chest or an abdomen. For junctional wounds, that's where the limb meets the torso, like the groin or the armpit. A standard tourniquet won't work because there's no cylindrical limb to compress. Those require wound packing with hemostatic gauze and direct pressure. There are specialized junctional tourniquets, but those are not what most people have in their kits, and they require specific training.
The mental model is, if it's a limb, and it's bleeding hard enough to kill someone, tourniquet. If it's anything else, pack it and press.
That's the heuristic. And I'd add, if you're not sure whether it's arterial, apply the tourniquet anyway. The risk of applying one unnecessarily is vastly lower than the risk of not applying one when it's needed. A tourniquet left on for 30 minutes while you get to a hospital is not going to cost someone their limb. A femoral artery bleed left uncontrolled for 3 minutes will cost someone their life.
That's the kind of clarifying math that should be on the packaging. This might hurt. Not using it will kill you.
The data backs this up. The military experience showed that tourniquet application before the onset of shock resulted in a 96% survival rate. When tourniquets were applied after shock had already set in, the survival rate dropped to something like 4%. The timing isn't just important, it's everything.
4% versus 96%. That's not a marginal difference, that's the entire game.
That's with young, otherwise healthy soldiers. In a civilian population that might be older or have comorbidities, the numbers would likely be even starker. The takeaway is, if you think you might need a tourniquet, you already need it. Apply it immediately.
Let's talk about the practical skill of application for a moment. The placement rule, 2 to 3 inches above the wound. But I've also heard high and tight as a doctrine. Which is it?
This is one of those areas where tactical medicine and civilian medicine have slightly different philosophies. The 2 to 3 inches above the wound approach is what's taught in civilian stop the bleed courses. The idea is that you're preserving as much viable tissue as possible, which gives the surgeons more to work with if reconstruction is possible. The high and tight approach, as high on the limb as possible, as tight as possible, comes from combat medicine, where the environment is chaotic, the patient may be in full gear, and you might not be able to fully expose or assess the wound. High and tight eliminates guesswork.
Which one should a civilian use?
If you can see the wound clearly and you know where it is, go 2 to 3 inches above it. If you can't see the wound, if it's dark, if there's clothing you can't remove, if there are multiple wounds, go high and tight. The principle is, don't place a tourniquet over a joint, because the joint will protect the artery from compression. And don't place it directly over a wound, because that's both ineffective and excruciating. Other than that, err on the side of higher rather than lower. You can always place a second one lower if the first one doesn't fully stop the bleeding.
You mentioned earlier that 2 tourniquets are sometimes needed for thigh wounds. Why is that?
The femoral artery is big and it runs deep. It's buried under a lot of muscle and fat, especially in the thigh. A single tourniquet might not generate enough circumferential pressure to fully occlude it. If you apply one and the bleeding continues, you apply a second one immediately above the first and you tighten that one too. This is standard protocol and it's why carrying 2 tourniquets is not paranoia, it's planning.
The second tourniquet is not a backup in case the first one breaks. It's a simultaneous tool for the same injury.
And that's a nuance that most basic first aid courses don't cover. If you're building a serious kit, 2 tourniquets side by side in an easily accessible location is the standard.
Let's circle back to storage for a minute. You said 5 to 10 years in original packaging, 2 to 3 years in a car. What about the tourniquet that's been staged and is sitting in a hiking backpack?
A hiking backpack is actually a pretty good storage environment compared to a car. It's usually not in direct sunlight for extended periods, and while it might get hot, it's not the 140-degree oven that a car becomes in summer. I'd say inspect it every season and plan to replace every 4 to 5 years. But the inspection is the real key. If the nylon strap shows any signs of fading or brittleness, if the Velcro doesn't grab like it used to, if the windlass has any hairline cracks visible under a bright light, replace it immediately, regardless of age.
What about moisture? If it gets wet, is it compromised?
Getting wet isn't a deal breaker. These things are designed to be used in the field, in rain, in water. But if it's been wet for an extended period, like it sat in a damp basement for a year, you might get mildew on the strap and that can weaken the fibers. Dry it thoroughly after exposure and inspect. If it smells musty or the fabric feels different, replace it.
The replacement rule is basically, use your eyes and hands, and when in doubt, swap it out. A $30 tourniquet is not the place to be frugal.
A quality tourniquet costs about the same as a nice dinner for two. It lasts for years. And in the one moment you need it, it's worth more than everything else in your kit combined. The cost-benefit analysis here is so lopsided, it's almost absurd.
The insurance premium that covers exactly one thing. And that thing is catastrophic.
And here's a practical tip. When you replace your tourniquets, don't throw the old ones away. Mark them clearly as training devices. Put bright tape on them, write training only in permanent marker, and use them to practice. That way, your replacement cycle also builds your skill level. You're not just refreshing your equipment, you're refreshing your competence.
That's smart. So the old one becomes the practice unit, and the new one goes into the kit. You're building a training arsenal over time.
If you have kids, get them involved in the training, not in a scary way, but as a practical skill. A 10-year-old can learn to apply a tourniquet to an adult's limb. They might not have the hand strength to tighten it fully, but they can understand the steps and the reasoning. In a family emergency, every pair of hands matters.
Let's talk about the different tourniquet designs in a bit more detail, because I think the variety is interesting and not everyone knows what's out there beyond the CAT.
The CAT, the Combat Application Tourniquet, is the workhorse. Windless design, one-handed application possible, very well tested. The Gen 7 is the current version. They added a reinforced windlass clip and a single routing buckle that speeds up application. The SOF Tactical Tourniquet is the other big name. It's made by TACMED Solutions, and it has a few design differences. A wider strap, an aluminum windlass instead of polymer, and a screw-like tightening mechanism. Some people prefer it because the wider strap is thought to cause less tissue damage and the metal windlass feels more robust. The downside is, it's slightly heavier and bulkier.
The SAM XT?
The SAM XT is the newest of the three, and it's innovative. Instead of a traditional windlass rod, it uses a ratcheting clamp mechanism. You pull the strap tight and then squeeze a handle repeatedly to ratchet it down. It's extremely fast to apply, and it's probably the easiest to use one-handed on yourself. The downside is it's more expensive, usually around $40 to $45, and it's a bit bulkier. But for a personal kit where you might need to self-apply, it's an excellent choice.
What about the old-school ones? The kind with a stick and a strip of cloth, the improvised tourniquet.
I want to be very careful about how I answer this, because the improvised tourniquet has a place in history and in extreme survival situations, but it's not something anyone should plan to use if they have access to a purpose-built device. The failure rate of improvised tourniquets is very high. In studies, they fail to stop arterial bleeding in something like 60 to 70% of cases, even when applied by trained personnel. The problem is that improvised materials, a belt, a strip of shirt, a bandana, are usually too wide or too narrow. They don't maintain tension, and the windlass, if you even have one, tends to slip or break.
The belt tourniquet from the movies is basically a fantasy.
It's a dangerous fantasy. A belt is wide, it's hard to tighten adequately, and it's almost impossible to secure once tightened. The amount of circumferential pressure you need to occlude an artery is significant, and a leather belt with a buckle just isn't designed to generate or maintain that kind of force. If you have literally nothing else, you can try, but the odds are not in your favor. This is why carrying a real tourniquet matters. It's not a luxury, it's the difference between a tool that works and an improvisation that probably won't.
Which brings us to the question of where to carry them. We talked about accessibility, but what does that actually look like in practice?
The ideal is on your person, not in a bag. If you're hiking, a tourniquet in an ankle holster or on your belt is accessible even if you drop your pack. If you're driving, a tourniquet mounted to the visor or in the door pocket is reachable even if you're pinned in your seat. For a home kit, mount it on the wall or keep it in a dedicated, labeled pouch at the very top of your first aid supplies. The principle is, you should be able to reach it with either hand, without moving more than an arm's length, and without opening more than one fastener.
For a family with kids, we talked about adult tourniquets working on most children, but what about the practical reality of a parent needing to apply one to their own child? That's a psychological barrier that's different from applying it to a stranger or to yourself.
That's a hard question, and I think it deserves an honest answer. Applying a tourniquet to your own child is going to be one of the hardest things you'll ever do, psychologically. It will cause pain. Your child will scream. Every parental instinct will tell you to stop. And in that moment, you have to override all of that and complete the application, because the alternative is your child bleeding to death in front of you.
The psychological preparation is part of the training.
And I don't think enough first aid courses address this. The technical skill is one thing. The emotional regulation required to perform that skill on someone you love is another thing entirely. The best preparation, aside from hands-on practice, is simply having thought about it in advance, having made the decision ahead of time that you will act, that you will accept the temporary pain to prevent the permanent outcome. It sounds dark, but that mental rehearsal matters.
It's the same principle as any emergency preparedness. You make the decisions before the emergency, so you're not making them during it.
The time to decide how you feel about tourniquets is not when someone's femoral artery is pumping blood onto the floor.
All right, let's hit the legal and liability question, because I know someone listening is wondering, can I get sued for applying a tourniquet? What if I do it wrong and the person loses their limb?
Good Samaritan laws vary by jurisdiction, but in general, if you're acting in good faith to provide emergency care, you're protected from liability. In the United States, all 50 states have some form of Good Samaritan law. The key elements are usually that you're acting voluntarily, without expectation of compensation, and providing care that a reasonable person would consider appropriate under the circumstances. Applying a tourniquet to a life-threatening hemorrhage absolutely qualifies.
The standard isn't perfection, it's reasonableness.
You're not expected to be a trauma surgeon. You're expected to do what a reasonable person with similar training would do. And given that the current medical consensus is tourniquet early for severe limb bleeding, applying one is arguably the most reasonable thing you could do. The legal risk of not acting, in some jurisdictions, might actually be higher. Several countries and some use states have duty to rescue laws that require you to provide reasonable assistance if you're capable of doing so.
That's a twist most people don't consider. The liability might be in not helping.
It varies, and I'm not a lawyer. But the ethical and medical consensus is clear. If someone is bleeding to death from a limb, apply a tourniquet. The legal system is not going to punish you for trying to save a life using the standard of care recommended by the American College of Surgeons.
Let's talk about a specific scenario that I think is worth covering, the tourniquet conversion. You mentioned earlier that only a medical professional should remove a tourniquet. But what happens at the hospital? What does conversion actually look like?
When the patient arrives at the trauma bay, the team will assess the tourniquet. They'll note the time it was applied. If it's been less than 2 hours, they may attempt a controlled conversion. That means they'll slowly loosen the tourniquet while having surgical backup ready, and they'll assess whether the bleeding has stopped or can be controlled with direct pressure or wound packing. If the wound is manageable without the tourniquet, they'll remove it and proceed with standard wound care. If the bleeding resumes, the tourniquet goes back on and the patient goes to the operating room.
If it's been more than 2 hours?
Then the decision gets more complicated. They'll assess the limb for signs of irreversible ischemia, that's tissue death from lack of oxygen. If the limb is still viable, they might still attempt conversion, but with much more caution and with the understanding that reperfusion injury is a real risk. If the limb is clearly non-viable, cold, stiff, no capillary refill, then the tourniquet stays on and the patient goes straight to amputation. It's a brutal calculus, but it's reality.
That time notation you write on the tourniquet or on the person's forehead is one of the most important pieces of information the trauma team receives.
It's critical, and write it in a place that's visible. On the tourniquet itself is good. On the forehead with a marker is better because nobody's going to miss it there. Time of application in military format are just the clock time. That's it. No other information needed.
What about improvised situations where you don't have a marker? Is there a backup?
Memorize it and tell the first responder. But honestly, just carry a marker. A Sharpie weighs nothing and takes up no space. If you're building a serious first aid kit, a permanent marker is part of the standard loadout. It's for the tourniquet time, and it's also useful for writing allergies or medical conditions on someone's skin if they're unconscious.
The humble Sharpie, unsung hero of emergency medicine.
Alongside the tourniquet itself, the gloves, and the hemostatic gauze. Those four items, tourniquet, hemostatic gauze, gloves, marker, are the foundation of a trauma kit. Everything else is secondary.
Let's circle back to hemostatic gauze, because you mentioned it for junctional wounds. What's the relationship between tourniquets and wound packing? When do you use one versus the other?
The decision tree is straightforward. If the wound is on a limb and the bleeding is severe, tourniquet. If the wound is on the torso, neck, head, or junctional area, wound packing with hemostatic gauze and sustained direct pressure. If you're not sure, direct pressure is the default. But if direct pressure isn't working and it's a limb, escalate to tourniquet immediately. Don't cycle through multiple rounds of pressure, repacking, pressure again. You're burning time and blood.
Hemostatic gauze. That's the stuff impregnated with kaolin or chitosan that promotes clotting?
Kaolin-based products like Quick Clot Combat Gauze are the standard. They work by activating the clotting cascade on contact. The technique for packing is important. You're not just laying gauze on top of the wound. You're packing it deep into the wound, directly onto the bleeding vessel, with sustained pressure for at least 3 minutes. It's a skill that benefits from training, just like tourniquet application.
The complete trauma response kit, by your standards, is two tourniquets, hemostatic gauze, gloves, and a marker. Anything else you'd add?
But that's a different episode.
Let's talk about the maintenance schedule in more concrete terms. If someone is listening and they have a first aid kit that's been sitting in their closet for 8 years, what should they do?
Open it today. Take everything out. Check every item, the tourniquet especially. Inspect the strap, the windlass, the clip. If it's been 8 years in a closet, the tourniquet might actually be fine if it was in its original packaging. But if it's been 8 years in a car, replace it without question. And while you're at it, check the expiration dates on everything else. Adhesive bandages lose their stickiness. Sterile packaging can degrade. A first aid kit is not a buy-it-and-forget-it item. It requires maintenance.
The first aid kit is a living thing, not a time capsule.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. And put a recurring calendar reminder in your phone. Every 6 months, inspect the kit. Every 2 to 3 years, do a more thorough refresh. It takes 15 minutes and it ensures that when you need the equipment works.
What about the tourniquet that's been carried in a pocket or on a belt every day? Law enforcement, security personnel, people who carry a trauma kit as part of their everyday loadout.
Daily carry tourniquets have the shortest lifespan. They're exposed to body heat, moisture, friction, and UV every day. For someone carrying a tourniquet on their person daily, I'd recommend inspection every month and replacement every year. It's aggressive, but the cost of failure is catastrophic. Some departments have policies requiring annual replacement of personal tourniquets, and that's a good standard.
A $30 annual subscription to not bleeding to death.
It's the best subscription you'll ever pay for.
Alright, before we wrap up, I want to hit one more scenario. What about tourniquets in the context of mass casualty events? Active shooter situations, bombings, things where there are multiple victims, and limited resources.
This is where the training philosophy shifts from tourniquet first to tourniquet fast and move on. In a mass casualty event, you apply the tourniquet as quickly as possible, high and tight, no time for precise placement, and then move to the next victim. You don't stay to comfort, you don't do wound packing, you don't do anything that delays getting the next tourniquet onto the next person. The goal is to convert immediate fatalities into survivable injuries as fast as possible, and then let the next wave of responders handle everything else.
It's a triage mindset. Tourniquet and go.
And this is why some people carry multiple tourniquets, not just for one person with a thigh wound, but for multiple victims. In the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing, bystanders used improvised tourniquets made from belts and clothing to save lives. But the after-action reports noted that if more people had been carrying purpose-built tourniquets, outcomes would likely have been even better. That event was a turning point in civilian tourniquet awareness in the United States.
The Boston Marathon bombing was a wake-up call for a lot of civilian trauma care. The Hartford Consensus, the Stop the Bleed campaign, all of that emerged from the recognition that bystanders are the real first responders in a mass casualty event.
The Hartford Consensus was published in 2015, and it explicitly called for tourniquets to be as available as AEDs in public spaces. The logic was simple. No one dies from an arm or leg wound if the bleeding is stopped in time. That's a solvable problem. It's just a matter of equipment and training.
We're now more than a decade past that, and most public buildings still don't have trauma kits alongside their AEDs.
It's a gap. Some places have made progress, airports, some schools, some government buildings, but it's nowhere near universal, and given that the cost of a wall-mounted trauma kit with...
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.